It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum number 18. Especially if you are a new listener, because it's been really good to see so many new people coming. Just to explain what Quantum is all about, we try to look at world news, really, from a Christian perspective. My name is David, and I'm based here in Scotland, but we do try and travel the world and just try and look at different things in this, what we hope ends up being about 20 minutes, but sometimes can be a wee bit more. In this episode, we're going to China and Ukraine and Derby and Brunei and Michigan and Hungary and the North Sentinel Islands in the Bay of Bengal. But let's begin with China. Now, this is a fascinating and really disturbing story.
Many countries use financial information to issue personal credit ratings to predict whether you're going to pay your mortgage or your credit card. But the Chinese government is taking the entire concept a few steps further than that.
It's allowing Chinese companies to formulate their own rating systems using all kinds of data, from individual online shopping choices to real-world traffic violations. Chinese consumers are adjusting to the idea that they're always being evaluated.
I think it is very useful, but the assessments are not fair sometimes. For example, I love buying video games, but the system gives very low ratings to that sort of purchase.
A complete credit system that links all your behavior together, like shopping and traveling, would be a better way to evaluate a person's social credit.
All of this is one big national experiment. The new credit systems are technically voluntary, though they're hard to avoid. But by 2020, the government will unveil a mandatory social credit system, rating the behavior of all citizens, whether they like it or not.
China plans to judge each of its 1.3 billion people based on their social behavior. They're going to set up a social credit score, and if you get enough in that, you'll get green channel benefits, and if you get a negative, then you'll find yourself possibly not able to buy train tickets, not able to move, not able to access the internet. And what we're talking about here is social credit for things like walking properly, not jaywalking. We're talking about losing things. I would imagine, for example, in the crackdown on religion, that those who are Christians will really suffer from that. It sounds horrendous. It sounds authoritarian. It sounds Big Brother. And it sounds like that because that's precisely what it is. And yet, as we'll see later in this podcast, it's not just in China this is happening. The corporations in the West are doing the same kind of thing. And so also are governments. There's a real threat to our freedom. It comes from the kind of authoritarian communist capitalism in China, but also from the authoritarian liberal capitalism in the West. Staying out in the Far East, let's come to Brunei, which has just decreed that anyone found illegally celebrating Christmas could face up to 5 years in prison, according to the Sultan of this small but very oil-rich state. They are concerned that those who excessively celebrate Christmas could lead the Muslim population astray. I find this quite strange, because my Muslim neighbours always send us a Christmas card, and very nice of them to do so. Brunei, in an amazing feat of liberality, has decided that Christians are able to celebrate Christmas, providing they do so in private, and providing they first inform the authorities that they're doing that. The local Islamic religious leaders have promoted this ban, warning that adopting the trappings of Christmas is tantamount to rejecting Islam. Local businesses have also been told that they are not to display Christmas decorations, including those well-known Christian symbols of Santa hats and banners with Christmas greetings. Merry Christmas in Brunei. Let's stick it across the Far East and Taiwan, the other China, although the big China won't like it being referred to in that sense. Taiwan has just voted to reject same-sex marriage.
The news will come as a major blow to LGBT activists throughout the region. The island has been seen as a trailblazer for gay rights in Asia. Jennifer Liu from the Marriage Equality Coalition spoke out against the results. Gay people are a part of this society. We shouldn't be excluded from the state system. Every family has its purpose and value in its existence. Every person living in this world has their unique purpose. 7 million voters backed the definition of marriage as the union of one man and one woman, ruling party lawmakers.
And this is quite a surprising turn of events, I think, for some. Certainly for the BBC, who on their website, which we link to, had a picture of a woman crying. Imagine rejecting same-sex marriage. But the Taiwanese government, despite what their court has said, or the Taiwanese people rather, despite what their court has said, have said that marriage is between a man and a woman, which it is. We don't have to go too far to find a rather bizarre spirit of Christmas in our own country, or at least in England, if you're from Scotland. And this is in the town of Newton Aycliffe. There is considerable concern about the fact that Father Christmas is a man. The clue is in the word father. But they don't want that to be the case. They want there to be a Mother Christmas. They want to make sure that the post of Father Christmas is open to male and female. Nothing like getting the important things right. I did, however, really like this from Martin Lewis.
It is time for us to get off this gift-giving treadmill. I think sometimes the best gift is releasing others from the obligation of having to give to you. Let's work together to ban unnecessary Christmas presents. Not for your spouse, not for smiling children under the tree, but that ever-expanding list of friends and cousins and teachers that we feel forced to buy. Do right now, if you're watching, use me as your excuse. Agree to make a prenup, a pre-Christmas no unnecessary present pact. Or at least do a secret Santa and cap it at a fiver or tenner. Or even better, say, you know what, I'm not going to give that extended lift gifts. I'm going to give to charity instead. Less pressure.
Martin Lewis is a commentator who often comments on mainly on financial affairs, and he's got some really good things to say. I remember particularly he's very highly praising the Christians Against Poverty organization. But I love what he has to say in this about Christmas and Christmas giving. I'm tired of the pressure to give presents to people who, one, you don't really know that well, and I'm tired of the pressure on people who don't have much feeling that they have to spend the little that they have on giving presents. Don't give unnecessary presents this Christmas, and don't expect them. We are a very, very rich society, and maybe we should give to those who have less. Now let's go on to consider the issue of censorship. It's a really interesting story coming from Derby Cathedral. We're at the time of year where Christian unions have carol services, and they usually organise them so well that they tend to be vastly more popular than official carol services in most universities. So, for example, in my own city of Dundee, the Christian union service will actually be in our church, and it will be packed. There will be several hundred students there. Now, the Derby University Christian Union wanted to use Derby Cathedral, and so they applied to use it and were given permission, and they wanted to have the Reverend Melvin Tinker, who is an Anglican vicar, to come and speak. He's fairly well known. However, when Derby Cathedral heard that it was him, they decided to ban him. And I think they banned him because he expresses the same kind of views that I express in this podcast.
Yeah, basically there are two columns, there's good and there's bad, there's moral, immoral.
And the homosexuality is in the bad,
homosexual practice is in the immoral category according to the teaching of the Bible.
It is the same as paedophilia. It's in the bad bracket.
No, it's not the same as paedophilia in that, in the same way that stealing is not the same as murder. Both
but it's
immoral.
In the bad bracket in your mind, isn't it?
It's in the bad bracket as according to the teaching of the Bible and in terms of basic moral categories, yeah.
So, again, it's very interesting because Darby have been quite happy to show films which would be regarded as erotic and blasphemous, no problem. Quite happy to have liberals who deny the gospel, but there is no room in their particular inn for anyone who would proclaim Jesus Christ. Or maybe that's not fair, maybe not to say anyone, but someone who seeks to proclaim the whole gospel. If you're prepared to water things down, if you're prepared not to put your head above the parapet, if you're prepared not to be controversial, in other words, if you're prepared to let the money changers stay in the temple, they're going to be happy with you. What was just as intriguing for me is the response of Derby Cathedral when this became public. In the article we've linked to in Premier Christianity, the headline is, "Cathedral denies banning vicar from preaching at carol service." Now this is what they actually say. The Very Reverend Stephen Hance, Dean of Derby, said, "I am aware of online comments this morning claiming that Derby Cathedral has banned the Reverend Melvin Tinker from speaking at the Derby University Christian Union carol service. The Dean invites all guest preachers for services to be held at the cathedral. This remains the Dean's responsibility even when the service is organised jointly with another organisation. Planning a service with an outside organisation always entails some back and forth, including about whom the Dean might invite to preach. It is entirely wrong to claim that anyone has been banned simply because the Dean has not chosen to invite them on this occasion." The Dean has not chosen to invite them. This is not banning. I've just not chosen to invite them. Now, at best, this is dishonest and deceitful newspeak, not worthy of a Christian church. But it's the kind of thing that people do. It's the kind of thing that they say. It really is quite appalling. This is... they have banned him. He was invited. Derby CU wanted to have him there. And the Dean said, no, you can't have your service here if you're going to have him. In most people's view of how words are used and the world, this is banning. But I guess if you're a liberal Christian who wants to demonstrate the love of Jesus, you've got liberty to lie. But of course, this is what's happening more and more in our culture, that people are being banned. Banned from churches and banned from universities. Universities which the key is in the word, they are universities, not monoversities, not just one view. But both Aberdeen University Students Association and Glasgow University Students Association have decided to ban pro-life student groups from affiliating with them because they do not reflect their values. I think the best comment on this comes from the journalist Stephen Daisley, who in the article we've linked to on the blog says this, "The student unrest of the 1960s and 70s was in part a battering ram against unquestioned and unquestionable authority. They wanted personal autonomy, academic freedom, and an opening up of the campus to alternative, even disruptive ideas. 4 decades on, students have no need for freedom. It's equality they're after, an equality of ignorance, a rigid conformity that calls itself diversity. Ideas are harm, speech is violence, alternative views are dangerous. The grandchildren of the radicals have become the new authoritarians." In my own case, there's one minister who contacted me to say that he'd been going to speak at a university in Scotland to a student group teaching the Bible, and the Students' Association wanted to ban him. Why? Listen to this carefully. Because on his Facebook page, he had linked to 2 articles from the Weefly. They were going to ban him merely for linking to articles from me. I guess I'm not going to be worthy. But we're seeing more of this Chinese-style authoritarianism, not just in universities, not just in Anglican cathedrals, but also on with the giant corporations on social media. So I wrote a review of David Bennett's book, The War of Loves. Brilliant book, by the way. Read the review, but more importantly, read the book. And on a closed Facebook group, somebody posted that review, and they were banned, or it was blocked. That review was blocked. Now what's happening here? This is happening more and more. I think they've got an algorithm or something that anything that's perceived to be against LGBT in any way whatsoever is almost de facto banned. Or there are people who are reporting it for that basis. But this was a closed group. Really quite remarkable. This is the Brave New World. But let's continue with this theme of banning. There is an infamous play known as the Vagina Monologues. Used to be the cutting-edge cry of feminist liberation. But in the United States, anything we can do, the United States can do wackier. In the United States, there are universities are now banning this because it excludes women who don't have vaginas. It excludes women who don't have vaginas. The Women's Resource Center at Eastern Michigan University have just stopped productions of this play for its lack of trans sensitivity and its lack of diversity and inclusion. There you go. The revolution eating itself yet again. But my favorite story in this regard is from one of my newest allies, the radical feminists. As I said, I'm with you, sisters. And this one is a woman called Jean Hatchett, who tells the story of the Tutti Frutti hair salon in London, which tweeted out to a friend of hers, "We will not be able to take your booking on Thursday. Our salon is a safe space for the trans and queer community. We cannot serve anyone in opposition to this." So this feminist had said a man without a vagina is not a woman. And for saying this, they're being banned from getting their hair cut. I wonder if the Equality and Human Rights Commission are going to be on to them. I mean, if they prosecute someone who refuses to bake a cake because of their views on same-sex marriage, why won't they prosecute someone who refused to cut someone's hair because of their views on transgender issues? Of course they're not going to, because it's not about equality and diversity. It's about enforcing one view. Listen to this. Speaking of this, this transmania, listen to this from Piers Morgan.
If we look at how Brighton is as an area, it's got an extremely high LGBT population, it's extremely liberal. So when kids are in a school and they feel, oh, there's no stigma attached to being gender fluid or trans, so if they feel supported in an environment, then they're going to be questioning.
Why should they be encouraged to do this when it's clearly...
Because there's nothing wrong with being questioning about...
Nobody's going to persuade me that 76 kids at one school in Brighton woke up one day and decided to be gender
fluid. Well, who said that they woke up one day?
Now, what's going on here is a school in Brighton is saying that they have, I think, 76, about 40 children who are saying that they are not the gender they were assigned at birth, in other words, what they were born with, but they are a different gender, and there are another 36 who are saying they are gender fluid. Now, why is this happening? Is this because Brighton is such a liberal place and the school is opening out and people can be free, whereas everywhere else they're repressed? And it turns out that the figure of 0.001% of people being transgender is not true, that it's something like 10%. No, this is not even remotely that. It's because children are being abused and indoctrinated, not just through online propaganda, but there's this kind of social contagion that is being fed by government-funded groups, such as in Brighton, an LGBT charity called the All Sorts Youth Project, who have launched the UK's first group for trans or gender-questioning children aged 5 to 11. They have around 30 local members with an average age of 9. All Sorts received £166,000 in public and lottery funding last year. They also have a group for children aged 11 to 15. They also say that parents who question their child's wish to transition can be referred to All Sorts support groups or even reported to social services. Sex education teachers must tell children that most rather than all boys have a penis and most rather than all girls have a vagina. Welcome to insane Britain in 2018. There is an excerpt that a doctor sent me from the British Medical Journal, who pointed out that he was completely surprised to find in the British Medical Journal an agenda being pushed about LGBTQI plus friendly badges for staff who've undergone a training course to show, this is in a children's hospital by the way, to show the children that they're friendly towards this. It costs £5,000 of funds to develop this. Again, this is all being shoehorned into medicine. And again, I simply have to say, where are the doctors wearing crosses to show that they're friendly to the far greater percentage of the population that are Christian? Where are they? Why this one particular group?
The Jewish people have suffered great tragedy, and we've overcome it. You've alluded to it. And also the people of Hungary face great struggles, and you've overcome it. We have both built modern, vibrant states. We recognize the past as we seize the future. The future, I think, belongs to
Hungary, with its leader Viktor Orban. You know, he's meant to be a noted anti-Semite, and with his pro-family policies and so on, he's definitely fascist and heading that direction. That's what we're told. But the Hungarian people I speak to, including one in my own congregation, have a very different view. And here's a very interesting fact that was sent me by a Catholic. And it's a report from Commentary magazine on anti-Semitism in Europe, East and West. Listen to this. There are 100,000 Jews in Hungary. Not one experienced a physical attack last year. Britain has 250,000 Jews, and there were 145 reported incidents of physical attacks upon Jews in Britain. So go figure this. Hungary, which is supposed to be ruled by an anti-Semitic, right-wing, almost fascist regime, not one. And Britain, which is supposed to be a liberal democracy, 145. As they say, go figure.
Russia's navy chasing three Ukrainian ships. This video appearing to show the moment of impact. One ship rammed. Shots were fired. The ship seized. Two dozen Ukrainian sailors captured. Russian warplanes threatening...
Now, there's tension between Russia and Ukraine, and in fact, I've just heard that the Ukrainian army and people have been mobilized because they fear a Russian invasion. And I wouldn't put that past Putin. But it was reminding us of something that occurred in the 1930s. And we don't hear much about... You know that 5 to 6 million people were killed in the Holocaust? But 6 to 7 million people were killed by Stalin in Ukraine in what they call, I think it's the Holodomor. It's really utterly horrendous. Ukrainian people in Scotland were commemorating that recently.
No food at all. People were eating leaves from trees. The linden tree was a favourite. People were making bread from straw. It was a horrific event from everything that I've heard and read about. And I can't understand in this day and age why nobody knows about this horrific event.
The word Holodomor means death by starvation. An exhibition at the Ukrainian Centre in Edinburgh tells the story of these deadly 18 months. These are quotes from survivors who describe the dreadful conditions.
The famine was a malicious, intentional act. In this village alone...
And we do need to think about it, what was involved. Stalin deliberately starved 7 million Ukrainians to death. Surely that is something that should be commemorated and remembered. And finally, we move on to the story of John Allen Chow. Now, Mr. Chow has become infamous for becoming a martyr, some would say. He's a young American who went to visit one of the most remote places on Earth, the North Sentinel Islands in the Bay of Bengal. And he went there to communicate the gospel. He did not go as part of any missionary organization. He went on his own. And he's being portrayed as a villain.
All right, well, joining us now, one of the world's leading authorities on the tribes in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, Sophie Grigg, joins us from the United Kingdom. Sophie, thanks very much for being with us. Apologies, we couldn't come to you earlier. We've got breaking news. Sophie, to you first, it's very unfortunate what has happened over here. How vulnerable is this particular tribe, and why is it important to protect the North Sentinelese and grant them the isolation that they've always believed in?
Well, they are incredibly vulnerable. We consider them to be the most isolated tribe in the world, which makes them probably one of the most vulnerable peoples on the planet. They'll have no immunity or almost no immunity to the sort of diseases that outside people will carry, such as measles or flu. And it's absolutely essential that their land is protected and no attempt is made to contact them. And, you know, this sad situation.
I have a friend, Neil D.M. McLeod, who knew John Alan Chow, met him on a plane, had a long conversation with him, and appeared on the Jeremy Vine show to say something about him.
Do stay with us. Just going to speak now to Neil McLeod, who knew John Alan Chow. Hello, Neil.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Sympathies, first of all. I know you met him on an aeroplane, is that right?
Yeah, I met him about 3 years ago, flying out from Heathrow to Phoenix. He was charismatic, he was warm, he was engaging. He was a trained EMT, a paramedic, and had worked in disaster zones, and so knew the risks of pathogens and infection and disease. And so to say that he is ill-considered, I don't think is accurate. He was a very considered and thoughtful individual, I think.
And you're a Christian as well, so you understood what he felt his mission was.
Absolutely, yeah. His sense would be fulfilling the mission of God's people, and that is to present Christ to all people around the world. And, you know, he had a sense of that calling, but his calling wasn't, you know, just arguing about his beliefs on the internet. His point was about surrender and self-denial and sacrifice to serve the Lord that he loved. And, you know, that's a challenge that comes to me as a Christian, and I'm sure other Christians as well, as to what do we do for Christ and where do we serve that mission of Christ in our homes, in our communities, in the places that we work.
Did he mention the?
I think the article in The Spectator summarizes it best of all. I think this article gets the balance right. He must have known the risks, they said. He must have known the risks. Chow wanted to save them for Jesus, but he could have ended up harming them terribly. His approach to the island was illegal and a grave moral error, and yet there is more humanity in his error, in his clumsy Christian zeal, in his desire to reach out to these people, than there is in the warped response to what he did. People are laughing at Chow. They're denouncing him as a typical arrogant American. It would be better, eco-leftists and other lovies insist, if we just left the Sentinelese people as they are. They're probably happy. What, living brutish backward lives? I think it is crueler to abandon the Sentinelese people to the fate written for them by the terrible quirks of geography and history than it is to try to contact and civilize them. Well, let me go one step further. I think it's cruel to leave any people without telling them about Jesus. Mr. Chow may have been wrong in his methodology, he may have needed to think it through, but I tell you this, he was right in his motivation, and he should be lauded, I think, and not condemned. Well, it's St. Andrew's Day, and I'm going to leave you with the shortest of quotes. My quote for this week is from John Knox, "Give me Scotland, or I die." Knox wasn't prepared to leave the Scots in our barbaric ignorance. He wanted to bring us the good news of Jesus Christ. And that's what we're seeking to do. And let me simply say before you go that if you would like to support Quantum, then you can do so by going to our Podbean page. We have a support thing there. It's www.patron.podbean.com/theweeflea, and you can support us there. Hopefully see you next week. Keep sending in your comments, and please keep sending in your news stories. God bless. Bye.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get, they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, but makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens, trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than barking.